This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Emerald Kressel. He is the author of Black House Rocked. It is published by Ann Sterzinger's Hopeless Books, and he co-authored the book with Paul Bingham. Basically, it's a collection of two stories, a larger story by Paul Bingham and a shorter story by Emerald Kressel. Emerald, nice having you on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Robert. Hello?
So, Paul Bingham isn't able to join us. Are you able to talk about his story, or would you rather just focus on your story?
I don't know. I mean, his story is... We can talk about it, too, but I'd rather maybe just focus on mine, if that's all right.
Well, I've read both of them, so I can discuss it. First of all, so this is it's basically a book consisting of two different stories. How common is this concept of fitting two stories into one book? I know there's a specific term for it. I forget the specific term.
Yeah, it's called a split single. I wasn't even aware such a thing existed myself until Anne proposed the idea, I think, to put both stories together and release it as a split single. And I thought that was a pretty good idea, so I just went with it.
And your story, Twilights, is the first. It starts off, so it's very short. I mean, I would kind of describe it as it's like a poem, basically.
Yeah, someone else said that also in a review. I think it was James O'Meara who said that he likened it more to like a collection of prose poems himself. I mean, I can see how you'd read it that way, but I don't know. Just for expediency's sake, I just called it a short story and thought that, like, you know, to release it as in a short story format alongside another short story would be a pretty, I think it aesthetically it kind of works. So I just decided to go with it.
So Twilight is the main character. His name is Salvatore. he was a knight
Salvatore,
who fought
yeah.
in the Crusades, and then he was turned Salvatore.
That's right.
He was turned into a vampire, and what gave you the inspiration for writing this?
Sure. Salvatore, actually, the character was conceived back in 2010, actually. It was a character a friend of mine came up with, a friend of mine, it's sort of like vagabond, sort of just a delinquent vampire who's just kind of really angry all the time and sort of like never up to any good and always up to some sort of mischief. And originally we did a couple of short films actually about Salvatore titled Salvatore and Salvatore 2. I guess you could put those maybe like as in the description link or whatever. But yeah, so Salvatore basically started out as a video character for a video project. And after that, and then, I don't know, I just really liked the character a lot. I thought the character just came out really well on screen. And I don't know. And I think I just started writing, tried to like write like a backstory to him one day and kind of just evolved from there.
So I would describe the story about Salvatore. It's like a poem sort of describing him, but it's not necessarily, it's not a plot-driven story.
No, yeah, there's no plot. It's just a series of glimpses, twilights, if you will, into Salvatore's, like, maybe his, like, subconscious or something like that, you know, so his vast... you know, memory of having lived for, I don't know, like 800 years or something. So I think Salvatore's mind is very fertile ground for finding all sorts of things. And yeah, I don't know. I just kind of it's hard for me to write a story in the traditional way, to have a plot and like, you know, go from A to B. So I just had all these different sort of like scenes in my mind of like Salvatore doing different things, and I couldn't find any like way to like piece them all together other than just like asterisks, so you know, or just like totally like separating them into little paragraphs. So that's kind of how that kind of started, you know, just trying to string together all these different you know, scenes.
How does your story tie in with the theme of a Paul story?
Well, it's kind of, they both have similar, just a tone. And like the Watcher in Paul's story is, you know, ambiguously vampiric. But I think Paul described it really well once, when we were talking about it, when it was still in its, conceptual stages, the book, Paul described it almost like my story being kind of like a punk rock attack song, and then his story being more of like a slow burning, like a doom metal dirge, you know. And I thought that was really, really cool, actually. I thought that sounded great, and I thought it really well described the sort of like juxtaposition of our stories, you know.
Is a drawing on the front of the book, is that of Salvatore?
It could be, yeah. I mean, I drew it. It's my illustration. And, yeah, like, to me, it's Salvatore. But I guess it can be the Watcher as well, in a way. And it can be, I guess, it can be any sort of, it doesn't even really have to be a vampire, I guess, because you can't really see the fangs. So I guess just any sort of, delinquent, sort of psychotic being like on the loose, you know.
Well, it's very abstract. I was just reading, and it's very abstract. Like, it's not the way I put it. It's I think something very kind of dreamlike. Like, it's not something. It's like something that comes out of your subconscious, as opposed to something that you write out like logically.
Right, yeah, totally. It's really, just the nature of writing it was kind of that way. It was just, you know, different pieces of dialogue or just different little things just literally kind of surface up in my mind, and I feel the need to write it down. So, it's definitely more, more dreamlike than any sort of more realistic plot-driven, you know, piece of writing.
You had another book that you wrote that came out a couple years ago. Pen is Dad, that one.
Pen is Dad. Yeah, it's a poetry. Actually, I just released it, or it was just published on Amazon like a week ago, 2 weeks ago, something like that. So yeah, it was actually released around the same time, probably even to the day of Black House Rocked. It's just a little poetry book that that I kind of put together, some poetry, some poems I've had stored away for the past, 5 years or so. Just thought to, like, compile them and release them as a book since Black House Rocked was coming out. I thought it'd be pretty good timing to maybe release as a sort of companion piece, maybe, like a collection of some of my poems.
Is there a similar theme in the poems in Pan is Dad?
You mean Twilight's in Pan is Dad?
Yeah,
well, there's one poem, I think, actually, I might do a reading of it. There's one poem that I think sort of tonally is somewhere in that same place as Twilight's. It's a poem called In the Image of Prey. And if you would permit me to read it.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, go ahead.
Oh, okay, all right. So it's called In the Image of Prey. Their fires brought up great columns of smoke over the vast and vegetative blue land. Their cries broke over the tops of trees, over gorges, pummeling against the indivisible night. Horrible, stupid, meaningless cries, bottomless cries, came from their mauled, bleeding mouths like holes in their mangled faces steeped in hot muck and pus. They fed on their kill uncooked to the teeth and defecated openly on the ground and in the leaves. They were without language or memory. They knew not the sciences, the mysteries that had yielded to make them. Made in the image of their own prey, they were left alone for some time unwritten and to their own. Into this great vegetative blue land and its elements primal to fire. It was like this for some time when something else took place. So that's one poem out of my book, Pan is Dead. I feel like that poem sort of ties into just the general sort of maybe grotesque nature of Twilight's. Or certain parts of Twilight's. So yeah, there's that.
So there's a theme of death, would you say, in your poetry?
Yeah, death. Just decay and defecation and like just destruction, entropy, just sort of a general darkness. You know, all that gothic shit. You know. So that's pretty much, that's the place where these particular pieces of writing, Twilight's in this poem, came from, a kind of primordial place, I guess.
Were you in a dark place psychologically when you wrote those poems?
I mean, yeah, I think part of me was, But not to any significant degree. Like I didn't write it like, you know, in a mental ward or anything like that. But yeah, there's like certain things, certain parts of the mind, I guess, that I just would tap into to draw out this this imagery, I guess, you know. That place that we all sort of have access to, if you will.
Who have been some of your most significant literary influences?
That's a tricky question because I have kind of a broad, I guess. I mean, like everyone else, really, I'm sure. For this in particular, I was sort of really interested in like this writer, Donald Barthelme, is postmodernist writer. He was actually a short story. Most of his work is short stories. And he's just incredibly playful in his writing. And he's one writer, I think, in particular, when talking about Twilight's, if I had to say any sort of writer, that kind of probably be Donald Barthelme, probably a little bit of Robert Coover, who wrote this book called, or his collection of short stories called Prick Songs and Descants, which was a pretty big influence on me just in terms of my own work and what I would read since. But other than that, it's like it's a wide, broad horizon of different, like William Faulkner, I guess, let's see, poets like, you know, there's a lot. Who I really like that's out right now is, who's a really popular poet right now is this guy, named Michael Robbins, came out with this book of poetry called, Alien versus Predator, like back in 2012 or something. And I thought that was really, really, something exciting. And, but other than that, I'm not really sure what's going on too much in the poetry world, in the world of contemporary poetry. But yeah, like my influences are just really across the board. It would probably take like just a whole like 2 hours just to like get to the bottom of like every artist that impacted me.
So the second part of the book, and it's much longer, a longer story, is Paul Bingham's story.
Save the last bullet for me. Yeah.
Oh yeah, save the last bullet for me.
Yeah, I think another reason why our stories were paired up, because both of our stories have like sodomy as a kind of theme, so I think there's that for sure.
How is sodomy a theme in your story?
I guess it's sort of ambiguous, but you know, Salvatore is sort of having his way with you know, the little girl or whatever. It could be a little girl, whatever you want to like. Yeah, I think it's a little girl. So there's, you know, I don't know. That's kind of just the way it's read.
So
I think it can be read as sodomy. Yeah.
So your character engages in that, and Paul's character is falsely accused of it. That's the difference.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition to have one character, Salvatore, who's truly this, you know, he makes no bones about his own trespasses, and the character in Paul's story, on the other hand, is falsely accused of it, although, you know, one, you know, we can't really know that for sure, I guess, but so I think that's a pretty interesting, a way of putting it together, you know.
And there's a scene where when the main character, Jackson, he first gets to jail, there's another inmate who's a heterosexual rapist, but he makes fun of Jackson for being a homosexual sodomite.
Right. Yeah, well, there's that, you know, so, you know, that there's that touch to it. There's a whole, even going back to Paul's Down Where the Devil Don't Go, there seems to be a kind of a lot of homosexuality sort of peppered throughout, you know, or kind of maybe a repressed or closeted homosexuality. So, you know, there's that. But I think one can read this sort of thing into a lot of things. So, but yeah, I mean, you'd have to ask Paul that about that because, you know, I wouldn't know where that came from, if you will.
If he can, maybe we can see if we can get him to like call in at the last minute. But I don't.
That'd be great to get him a call. I tried to get him on, but he was being a little bitch about it, and you know, so I was really kind of trying to push for him to join me for this call, but because I don't like, I mean, you know, to do it on my own. I think Paul would certainly make a good foil to whatever I have to offer. So
yeah, he's not
around
right now.
Too bad we couldn't get him on.
Yeah,
he's probably busy chopping wood or something, you know. Anyway,
like,
yeah, so it's too bad.
Before we continue with the story, did you get a chance to watch that Poet and the Cat video that he wrote the script for, which is basically...
Yeah, I didn't finish it, but I watched, like, the first, like, 3 minutes of it and thought it was really, really well written, actually. I think, I was really impressed by it.
Yeah, I directed it. Paul wrote the script, which was basically poetry and about a poet. But I mean, you can watch it. It's up on my website. But
oh, you have a website? I didn't know that. I'll definitely check it out then. Yeah, for sure. I put a link on it on my page, on my Facebook page for people to see, because I just gave it like a 10 out of 10. I just thought it was really good. And thought, you know, it'd be probably valuable to other people. Yeah, you know, yeah. I've like 700, I have like 800 friends on Facebook now, and I only know, like, in person, like 10 of them, probably just a handful. So I have this huge, I have this wide audience of mostly like social justice warrior, like faggots and like young people, mostly millennials. They're pretty much all exclusively millennials. So I have this really fertile, ground for planting seeds, if you will.
Yeah,
and,
Paul's book just about has just about everything that would offend social justice warriors. Basically,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it just about every single racial slur you can think of is in the book.
Yes, and that's, I mean, you know, that's, when I was asked to do this with Paul, I mean, it was just, I was on board even before the question came up. I mean, it's just, you know, this stuff is so powerful in a positive way. It's doing so much good, I think, to spread this sort of awareness, that, you know, I'm on board 100%. You know, this is like, I couldn't be happier to be a part of it, if you will. You know, it's great.
And there's different themes in the book. It reminds you of a number of things. So there's the cinematic theme. It reminds me of a lot of there's a lot of movies that take place in the South and places like the Appalachians or the Ozarks, where you have outlaws who are out like running through the forest and the wood and the mountains in the South. It reminds me of a lot of movies. I mean, I forget the name of it, but there was a movie I saw about 5 months ago where there were this group of young boys who befriended a fugitive in the woods in some place like the Ozarks. It reminds me a little bit of that. And then from the literary influence, the main character, Jackson, I can sense, I think James O'Meara said this, but I get this as well. It reminds me of a lot of Andy Nowicki's character. When basically the character Jackson, first of all, his status as part of a group. So he's basically like a poor redneck. But then on top of that, he has a very low social status among even that group, which has a low social status in society. So he's someone who is kind of, he's basically, the character is basically like an outcast. And I've noticed.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think like that, I mean, the white nationalist group identity and just the kind of the alternative right, just, I mean, you know, I think, you know, it's no accident that the alternative right authors write so much about outcasts is because I think as a group, it's kind of just metaphorical of just where we're at. Where we stand, I guess, which is sort of on the fringes, unfortunately, as of yet. Although I suspect that's going to change real soon. But as of now, it's still a sort of outsider, perspective, position to play, you know. So I think that's no accident, and that's kind of where we're coming from generally, you know.
And I'm reading the review. There's a review by Ben Arzate. He calls it a Southern Gothic. That's kind of the theme I was getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely, if I had to describe it, it'd be a Southern Gothic literature. Paul's story, anyway. Mine, I mean, of course, is sort of outside of any sort of geographic place, but yeah, Paul's writing, just in general, even back to Down Where the Devil Don't Go, is just in particular that story. Shit, it's not, the title's not coming to me, but about the motorcycle like crusader. Anyway, yeah, definitely Southern Gothic. You know, that's definitely where Paul's from. You know.
There's a quote in the book, and this one quote definitely summarizes the theme of the book very much so. And it says, "When society kills somebody, they won't necessarily die for years."
Oh yeah, that's very good. Yeah, I mean that very well sort of sums up the whole. Yeah, it's a very good choice. You know, Salvatore is immortal, I guess, in that story, but different permutations of Salvatore can be killed off, maybe, and but you know, Salvatore is just sort of like maybe just kind of representative of the more like the darker side of whatever times he's living in. So when Salvatore is just kind of yeah, he can't be killed.
So I'd like to, and with the situation, there's the sort of political back and cultural backdrop of the town it takes place. So I think it takes place in Missouri, where Paul is, and the town, it's sort of like a, what's happened to a lot of towns in the South and the Midwest, where it's been economically decimated, like all the small businesses are shut down, and but there's a Walmart, and there's a lot of government buildings. There's the center of the town is the courthouse and the criminal justice system, but the economy has been totally shattered. And then there's also a lot of political themes. There's a politician. The judge is this overweight woman in a wheelchair who saves up her money and she goes off and gambles. Then the prosecutor is like a stereotypical Republican. And then there's this politician, I think he's running for either president or Senate, who's for open borders. So there's the watcher character who is, he's sort of like the vampire, and he goes around and basically kills off people in society that he wants, that he views as harmful. But the watcher character, I mean, he's also basically like a white nationalist as well.
Sure, yeah.
And so for people listening, like, since Paul's not here, I'm going to spoil some things. So if you don't want the show to be spoiled, I suggest tuning off right now. But the Watcher ends up kidnapping the main character, Jackson. So their paths cross. But I'm going to summarize it. So I'll summarize the storyline. So if you don't want it to be spoiled, I suggest turning off. So it first starts out, Jackson is working at a summer camp. Then he gets accused of sodomizing a little boy. And then from there, he gets arrested, and the FBI, they give him an offer. I don't think they agree to exonerate him, but they said they'll change his charge. They'll change his charge or something if he agrees to assassinate this woman, who she's kind of like the female counterpart to him, but she's mentally ill, and everyone in the town hates her, and she. I think she murdered someone. I forget if it was her husband or her stepson, but she basically murders someone. And then he goes off and finds her. Then they go off in the woods and hiding. And then from there, they go off into a cave. And then he finds this dead body. And then the dead body of this little girl, that goes to the story of this other guy who was on trial for rape and murder. And the Watcher is trying to assassinate he's trying to assassinate that guy's lawyer, and the lawyer is appointed by the SPLC. So yeah, I basically spoiled most of it, but that's pretty much my summary. Emeril, is there anything else you'd like to say about that story?
No, I mean, I think you did a great job you know, describing it. I would totally encourage people just to go out and buy it, you know. So there's that, you know, there you have it.
So before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, there is one thing I wanted to bring up, and that's there's this guy who actually, a friend of mine, helped publish my poetry book, Pan Is Dad. He also recently published a manifesto that he geared towards the white nationalist crowd. This manifesto is titled Hello, First Principles on Ending That Which We Oppose. And I was recently in Ameren this year trying to peddle this thing, and it's about as unpopular as you can get insofar as a point of view within white nationalism. But I do stand behind it 100%, and I would encourage anyone who is interested in my story or Paul's story or our book or my poetry to go out and also buy themselves a copy of this manifesto, which I think proposes a kind of new, even more alternative sort of perspective or approach to the war on racial egalitarianism. And it's a sort of, I don't want to give away too much, although in closing, I might read an excerpt from this manifesto to give the listeners a kind of general idea of what it is, what it stands for, and I shall begin. We should not permit ourselves to play the roles of the petty, villainous pretenders to some mythical white aristocracy who seek only to turn back the clock, nor those of bitter, masculinity-obsessed, history-obsessed pariahs whose emotional neediness requires a group identity for us to latch onto. I watch all of us blithely fall prey to the narrative of our opposition, becoming fodder for caricature, and it frustrates me immensely. Indeed, I part suspect and dearly hope that I'm preaching to the choir in saying this. We let ourselves be tricked into thinking that we are evil and bitter. We need to shake off these mental shackles. Stop reading Evola. Write a new narrative and play to win. Stop playing the complacent bad guy and begin practicing radical compassion. Moreover, remember that violent conflict is obsolete. Whoever resorts to violence has already by default lost the real war. Practice radical compassion so fervently and with such depths of the imagination, you have broken the human condition in half and sucked out its marrow. Be elusive and impossible to categorize. Show them that you've thought more earnestly and intensely into the problem of ameliorating the pangs of the human condition than they. Be restless, yet exude contentment and cheer. Know this. They will judge both your moral genius and the value of your insights not on the literal or logical content of your arguments, but rather on the subtlest aspects of your being, based on their success or failure in trying to categorize you according to the narrative of the anti-racist moral melodrama. Thus, again, be elusive and impossible to categorize. Force them to invent a new box to put you in, one stamped with the address that will deliver us all. Know this. And that is an excerpt from Hello, First Principles on Ending That Which We Oppose, written by Harlem Venison. And that is also available on Amazon in paperback. So I highly recommend and encourage all listeners to go out and buy themselves a copy of this book and maybe even buy 10 copies of this book and give away the other 9 to anyone remotely intelligent in their nearest like vicinity. So this needs to happen, and I stand behind this. And, 819, Hail Hitler.
Okay, but I think it's really interesting to have people write fictional, to get their message across writing fictional stories. a lot of people like to just write political books, talk about politics, but if you want to really make an impact on the culture, is to write fiction work.
I agree 100%, actually. I agree totally. But I think but this is still a really, really interesting approach to what we're facing. So and I couldn't really have said some of these things better myself in whatever context, fiction or nonfiction. So it's a really good piece of work. But generally, I would agree with you. I think that we shape things through fiction and through imagination. So that's I agree.
So Emerald Kressel, I would like to thank you for being on. Check out the book,
sure.
Black House Rocked.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me, Robert, and it was a good. Great conversation. Too bad Paul couldn't join us, but anyway, yeah, no, too bad Paul couldn't join us, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I did my best summarizing his book, but it doesn't compare to having the author there to talk about his own work.
Yep, that's true. Anyway, yeah, thanks for having me, and 8:19, etc.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.